You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rachel O'Brien, and I'm commissioning editor of the RSA Journal, but also I run a community interest company called Transitions, which started off as a project working with prisons funded by the RSA. So thank you for RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here today for this evening's special events, the 2015 Albert Medal presentation and lecture. The RSA has been awarding the Albert Medal for innovation in the fields of creativity and social improvement since 1864. Recent past recipients include public services innovator Dr. Simon Duffy, and I'm going to say this name wrong, I suspect, but Zareen Karas, who's co-founder of Just Giving, which has been incredibly successful fundraising tool, and community care leader Jos de Blok. The Albert Medal has evolved over the years to the point where it is now recognised as a means of identifying and rewarding those who are at the forefront of practical social innovation. Those often unsung heroes who are driven by a desire to make the world a better place. And tonight's Albert Medal winner is James Timpson. He's just such a person. James is the chief executive of Timpson, the family retail business, which has been operating since 1865, and which now has a workforce, I believe, of over 3,500 employees and well over 1,000 outlets. Timpson's creative and committed workforce responds to an innovative system of enterprise management, which includes a philanthropic approach to recruitment, in particular working closely with prisons across the UK. James has built a training and employment model which offers opportunities for people who have been in prison and who want to change their lives for the better. The main focus today is on that kind of James's thoughts about how the business itself operates, particularly in terms of how what they call an upside-down form of management, where we really give trust to the people at the front line. James chairs the Employers Forum for Reducing Reoffending, which is a group of like-minded employers who offer a second chance to people with a criminal conviction. His passion, enthusiasm for business, people, his team and the wider community was recognised in the Queen's Birthday Honours List in 2011, where he's presented with an OBE. James, we're delighted to have you join us here today at the RSA and to accept the medal, the Albert Medal, and to share the principles that guide your business practice and your experience of growing Timpson into the successful enterprise it is today. It now gives me great pleasure to present you with the 2015 Albert Medal for successfully uniting the commercial and social benefit aspects of your business.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
James asked earlier, after this, you know, will you be asking us to do more things? And we said, yeah, absolutely. So this is, we'd like to accept an honorary life fellowship, and that means we can ask you to come back and talk again.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. When I got the letter about the Albert Medal a few months ago, I had to reread the letter a few times because I couldn't believe that I was being asked to do this. So thank you very much, and I hope I come up with the goods, and I hope you find what I'm going to talk about over the next 20 minutes stimulating and thought-provoking. So thank you very much, everybody involved. When I was... I got on the train at Runcorn this afternoon to come down to Euston, and I started reading a book which I hadn't read in years, which was written by my great-great-grandfather in 1936. And it was the history of his father, who was the founder of our business, talking about what happened and how he started off. And I thought I'd just relay the basic story. When he was 8 years old, he left school and he started making leather shoelaces in Kettering and selling them for a bit of money. And then he decided when he was 14 that he needed to earn a proper wage, so he went to Manchester, which at the time was a thriving industrial city, and his place where he could get work, and his uncle lived there. So he was dropped off, or I guess he walked to the Kettering train station, and because he'd never been on a train before, unfortunately he got on the wrong train and ended up in Sheffield. So instead of going to Manchester, he went to Sheffield. And when he got off the platform there were no further trains that day to Manchester, so he slept on the platform. And in the morning, he had no money, didn't know what to do, he was crying. This very nice gentleman asked him why he was crying, and eventually they gave him the money and bought him the ticket so he could get to Manchester. And ever since then, there's always been an ethos in our business about helping those on their uppers. And it seems to have done okay for us, because we've managed to keep going as a family business, admittedly through some difficult times, but we are still a family business. So he got to Salford, started opening up shops, and then in 1903 started repairing shoes. And my first example of repairing shoes wasn't too far from here. It was in Cannon Street Station, just down the road. I'd left school, I was on my gap year, and I was sent to go and run the shops in London, which in those days were run completely differently from the way we run them now. And I found it quite straightforward. Every shop I went into, I tripled the turnover. Now, I'm not the world's best shoe repairer at all, never will be, but how did I triple the turnover? Well, the first thing I did is I put all the money in the till. That doubled the turnover. That was quite a simple way of doing things. And the other thing, because I was the boss's son and I was quite naive, I could break all the rules. I didn't really know what the rules were. So I could order whatever stock I wanted. I could do deals. I could change the displays. I opened the shops up longer. And where every shop I went to, this happened over and over again. So I thought, right, if I can do this, why can't everybody else do this? I went to university, then I came back into the business, and that's when I really started to work at what sort of business do I want to work in? What is the culture that I want my colleagues to be working in? So I decided to look around to see what other people did, and it occurred to me there were sort of different cultures that I could pick. The one that I felt very comfortable with was the John Lewis type culture, where everybody's a colleague, everybody's treated equally, there's a very long-term view. There's another business called Richer Sounds, which I'm a big fan of. And again, everybody is the colleagues who serve customers are really, really important, and everybody's nice and friendly and kind. Or you could go completely the other way, which is a culture that's all about money. It's all about making money at all costs. And I'll give you some examples of that, whether it's... I'm a retailer, so WH Smith's or Sports Direct, or even Phones For You, which has gone bust. And they seem to do very well for a short period, but they run out of gas pretty quickly. Or do I pick somewhere in the middle, somewhere where it was started off by an entrepreneurial family, like Greggs or QuickFit or Pets at Home, and then it becomes corporatized, and they sort of sit quite uncomfortably in the middle, because they understand that they want to be looking after their colleagues and doing the right thing, but actually money really makes the decisions. So I was pretty clear that I wanted to run the business by treating everybody as an equal and have a long-term view. So I looked around different companies in Europe, even in North and South America, and I decided what was actually the most important thing was those colleagues. We do colleagues, not staff, very important. Our colleagues who serve customers and put money in the till are the most important people in the business. They are the kings and queens, the number ones. They can do whatever they want to serve customers the way they see fit. Everybody else's job isn't to tell them what to do, isn't to invent rules and systems and processes, it's to let them get on with it. So when we started talking about this new structure, realistically, to change a culture takes 5 years. And I had some big battles to win, especially at what was then called head office, is now called Timpson House. But it took a good 5 years, and now we're sort of 20 years further on, and upside-down management is the only way to run our business. And every time we've bought another business or gone into a different type of retailing, we've always done it the same way, which is those wonderful people who serve our customers are the kings and queens of the business. So how can you just implement this? Well, the things we learned that you need to do as part of this are pretty straightforward. The first one is you only have two rules. So many organisations have so many rules, processes, guidelines in place to stop the 5% of idiots being an idiot. But the problem is the 95% of the wonderful people in the business also have to abide by these rules. So we have two rules. The first is you put the money in the till. We still, unfortunately, have one or two colleagues a week who fail to recognise the difference between their money and my money. So we're very, very clear, you put the money in the till. And the other is you act the part, which common sense things, you turn up on time, you're nice, you're kind, you're polite, you don't smoke in the shop, you don't have your friends in the shop all day, and the rest, you can do whatever you like. You can charge whatever you like. You can order whatever stock you want. You can do displays however you wish. We even have a shop that's painted pink because the manageress in Faversham likes pink. And that's fine. But as long as you play by our two golden rules, so many organisations have more and more rules as the business matures and grows, which makes it harder for anybody to actually operate in that business. So we have our two rules, but the real problem with our business 20 years ago was there were lots of people working in it who weren't that great. So the lesson I learned is I want to recruit wonderful people, but I need to look after them. So what do I mean by looking after them? Everybody wants to work in a business that you feel valued. So again, I went around and borrowed ideas off other companies, changed the way it works. So, for example, if you work for us, everybody gets their birthday off as an extra day off. We have colleague loans that we give loans to everybody. If you get married, we provide you a wedding car and a driver for the wedding, and you get an extra week off and flowers for the wedding. We do dreams come true. We every week we make two dreams come true for colleagues. And it's not to go on a lad's trip to Magaluf. It's to take your children who've been poorly to Disney. It's to put a stairlift in the house so your parents can come and live with you so you can care for them. And what we like to do is to help our colleagues outside work because we know what a difference it makes to them when they're in work. And it's not just the way they buy into our culture, it's their partners and their families that buy into our culture. So we need to have our two very clear rules, and we really need to look after our people and genuinely look after our people. We don't do it because it's, you know, we have to tick a box. We do it because we believe in looking after our wonderful people. But how do we get our wonderful people? We have a very simple way of recruiting. It's all about personality. We don't do psychometric testing. We don't put you in rooms with one-way mirrors and see how you interact with straws or anything like that. We look at your CV, and we're only looking for two things. What's your name and what's your phone number? We aren't interested in anything else. If I'm really honest, if you've been a shoe repairer before, we probably really don't want you. We want people who've got no experience, but they've got experience of life. So you sit down and we have a chat with you, normally 5-10 minute interview. And we'll ask you about your hobbies, where you last went on holiday, tell me something you're interested in. And we're trying to work out what your personality is. Because we only want people who are fun, interesting, engaging, look you in the eye, they've got a buzz about them. I don't want moody, lazy, grumpy, scruffy people. Even though they may be the world's most qualified, incredible exam results, CV to die for, all I want is the personality. So, unfortunately, sometimes we recruit people whose personality doesn't fit, or we buy a business where we inherit colleagues whose personality doesn't fit. So we are very, very clear that those who aren't right for us need to find their happiness elsewhere. So no one ever leaves us, they just find their happiness elsewhere. And to have a very clear culture, you have to have a very clear recruitment policy on the type of people you all want to work with. Because otherwise, a culture doesn't work. So the way we have run the business is those colleagues who serve customers are the number ones. We have two very clear rules. And I was asked a couple of days ago, how long did your budget process take? We don't even do budgets. The most important thing in our business is just how many good people have we got? I don't even really need to see the sales figures. All I need to know is how many good people we've got. So I remember, must be about 18, 20 years ago, I was working in our shop in Windsor. And I was working with a colleague called Ross, and he didn't turn up on the Saturday. Didn't know what happened. And then I eventually got a call from his mum to say he'd been locked up. Fighting on Friday night. Bit of a problem because he's really good. So when he was out 2 weeks later, I picked him up from prison and then got him back in. Happy days, it was all back on. So when I was invited to go to a local prison in Warrington near where I live, I thought it would be a great opportunity to go inside and have a look. Because when I was younger, sort of 7, 8 years old, my parents fostered children. And my parents used to specialise, well, it was my mum really who did most of it, used to specialise in babies. So there's a women's prison in Stile, just by Manchester Airport. And I used to go there to take the babies to go and see the mum. And because I was too young, I was never allowed the other side of the wall, so I was always interested to go the other side to see what went on. I remember turning up, and this young lad, one of the inmates, 19 years old, gave me a tour round. Exactly the sort of personality that I wanted. Buzzy, lively, fun, interesting, engaging. Had a chat with him, never been to prison before. If any of you have ever been to Mr. Smith's nightclub in Warrington, he was there, he had a fight with someone who made an advance to his girlfriend. He got 3 years for ABH. He thought his whole life was over. So I slipped in my business card and said, listen, when you're out, give me a ring and I'll give you a job. At the time, we did have a vacancy in our local Warrington shop. Anyway, a few weeks later, his mum phoned me. Not Matthew, his mum did. And to cut a long story short, he's still with us now. So I thought, if I can get people like Matthew, who then goes into the shops and is really good, why can't I get some more? So I went around more prisons. At the time, I didn't tell anybody in the business what I was doing, but I was intrigued. I thought I could be onto something here. So I set my goal of 10 ex-offenders, or as we call them in our business, foundation colleagues, to work in the business. And I recruited some absolutely fantastic people. I also recruited some tricky people who at the time I thought I could solve, I could fix it. So I paid people's drug dealers off, and more, on more than one occasion, and I gave people, you know, more than 9 lives. It kept going and going. And it got to the stage where I had one colleague who I was sort of fighting his corner a lot until he punched a customer and then tried to burn down the shop. And I thought, no, I need to sort of get this sorted. So I worked harder and harder, going to more and more prisons, interviewing more and more people. And what I worked out is, really in the prison population, I'm recruiting for about a third of the prison population. I don't recruit sex offenders, because in our shops we take photos of children and adults, part of our ID photo business. And there are a number of people in prison who are actually not well enough to work. Having a job would be the worst thing that could happen to them. So I see myself as recruiting from about a third of the prison population. My ideal prisoner is 23, 24 years old, preferably a woman, and they have a hook on the outside. So they've got kids, they've got a relationship they want, they've got a reason that they want to get out and do normal. They're fed up of chaos, and they see working for us as a pretty straightforward thing to do. So I got to 10, and then I got all my area managers together in a room a bit like this, and told them what I'd done. I thought, what is the reaction going to be? And two things surprised me. The reason why they weren't too bothered is the people I'd recruited were really good. And the other is, a number of them had actually had to lie on their application form many years before because they themselves had criminal convictions. And, you know, there are 10 million people in this country who have criminal convictions more than a driving offence. So I had the green light, so I decided to really go for it. So then we went to Liverpool Prison, and I saw these dreadful workshops where, you know, you read stories about people sewing mailbags together, and it was bad. People were asleep. I remember going into Lindholm Prison in Doncaster on a cold winter's day and to go into a kitchen where they were training them how to cook. But all the ovens were on, the doors were open, and they were just keeping warm while they played cards. It was dreadful. So I thought, I'm going to have to open up my own workshop so I can train people how to get the skills I need so when they're out, they can join us straight away. Because one of the things we found is that if someone leaves prison today, they need to start working for me tomorrow. If you leave a gap of even a week, it all starts to go wrong pretty quickly. So I decided to open up this training academy in Liverpool. Similar sort of size of room to this. Everyone was wearing Timpson aprons, ties. It looked, you know, looked great. They learned how to repair shoes, repair watches, engrave things. We even had a little a prison officer's shop. And everything was going well. Obviously, they couldn't cut keys there because that was slightly too far. But we learned an awful lot, and we found some really good men in there. So we decided we'll do some more. So we opened one up in Wandsworth, complete disaster. The governor of Wandsworth, the culture of Wandsworth was dreadful. It just didn't work at all. So then we've opened up in Blantyre House, and we've got a women's one because we also own a photo business called Max Spielman, and we have one down in London called Snappy Snapped as well. So we opened one in a women's prison about 5 years ago. So we used a combination of recruiting people from prisons when they're about to leave, but also training them when they are in prison. And the one thing that really worked for us is a thing called ROTL, which is released on temporary licence. So this is when people are in the final stage of their prison journey, but they are deemed to be a compliant prisoner, ready for release, so they can work outside. So today we have 9 shops being run by people who are spending tonight in prison. So they'll wake up tomorrow morning, they'll get in their car or a bus, get to our shop, unlock the door, serve customers all day, bank the money, order the stock, do everything as anybody else would, and go back to prison at night. And I can guarantee all of those placements will be successful. So we got to the stage where now 10% of all of our colleagues are Foundation colleagues. So that is over 400 ex-offenders working in our business. It always slightly amuses me, we have 3 colleagues who were convicted for fraud working in my finance department, and they are some of the best people we have. So it's not just working in our shops, it's also working in our offices and in our warehouses as well. And we are really proud to have them as colleagues because they're really good. When we go into prisons, we are recruiting better people than we can often find on the street. They stay longer, they're more loyal, they're more honest, and they take more money. So as a commercial leader of a business, that's exactly what I'm looking for. So we've helped a number of other organisations follow our lead. And it got to the stage a few months ago where we went to Drake Hall Women's Prison near Stafford. And we were trying to recruit some ladies. We opened a few shops just north of Birmingham. But Greggs had been in the week before and nicked all the good ones. So we can see that the whole thing is starting to work. So if I was writing a book about my role in the business for my children and grandchildren to read, as I read this book on the train this morning, what would be my wish list of how the organisation is run? And I suspect it'll be a very different type of organisation. They'll probably still be repairing shoes, hopefully cutting keys, maybe watches will have disappeared, maybe everyone's got an iWatch, I don't know. But for me, there are 4 really important things. The first is, every organisation, it doesn't matter whether it's a public sector organisation, a charity, a business, a school, it needs to have a culture of trust. We recruit people because we think they're fantastic. We recruit people who have mortgages, who have children, who go on holiday, who have pensions and insurance and so on, but we don't trust them to do the most basic things in most organisations. So we want an organisation based on trust. And if people mess up, we trust them to fix it. So everybody wants to work in an organisation where they're trusted to do a really good job. And that's how you get innovation. That's how people are allowed to break the rules and you learn how to find new ways of doing business. The only reason why we repair watches is because Glenn, who works for us in West Brom, started repairing watches on the side because his turnover was so bad and he used to be a watch repairer. And I remember going there one day and he had a little sign in the window saying watch straps and batteries, $2.99. And when I walked in, he thought he was going to get a real telling off. But when he told me how much money he was taking, I thought it was fantastic. So you know, we need a culture of trust. I think the era is over of being a bad company to work for, not looking after your people. It is so obvious that you want to look after your great people. The amount of money I spend every year on dreams come true, on wedding benefits, on loans, on discount cards, we have a whole myriad of extra special things. We even have 8 holiday homes, which we own, colleagues can go on a free holiday. That is the best money I spend. That is the most efficient use of money any organisation can spend. So I think it's so important to look after your people. You know, if you look back in the past, you know, Lord Leverhulme and the Roundtrees and the, you know, the organisations used to do it in the Victorian times. It was, you know, it was the obvious way of having a great company. But that seems to have gone out the window. But I hope that in the future, people recognise that it's actually a good commercial thing to do, to look after your people. It seems obvious to us, but we've learned the lessons over 20 years, that you recruit people based on personality more than anything else. Yes, there are certain roles where you need specific skills, but really, if you look at so many leaders of today, they didn't have those classic educational upbringings. They had the personality and that will to succeed. So I think it's important that we recruit from all groups. And recently we've had a lot of success recruiting ex-military. I think we have 70 ex-military colleagues working for us now. And, you know, we've now started to look to recruit care leavers, long-term unemployed, and other groups where they find it hard to get work. Because what we find is that because other people aren't recruiting from these groups, I'm getting the best of the bunch. And I would love to actually get to a time when I don't get the best of the bunch, and we have to work harder to find those fantastic people. So it's not companies' jobs to solve the problems of society, but I think we can have a very important role to play. 85% of kids who are excluded from school will end up in prison. What's going to happen to them? Who is going to employ them? Who is going to believe that they have a future? From my experience, the people we recruit from prison are some of the brightest people we've got. They're sharp. They may have failed at school. A lot of our foundation colleagues failed at school. But they make fantastic colleagues. And we today have two area managers who look after big businesses who we recruited from prison. Anybody else would have overlooked them. So we need to recruit on personality and not be blinded by the whole sort of HR tick the box. How many of you have filled out an online application form and it's just been sent back because you didn't tick all the boxes? They want you for your personality, not necessarily your skills. And for me, the other thing that's very important from organisations is you need a long-term view. Those organisations that do have a long-term view, and I come back to John Lewis again, seem to be able to ride out the storm. Yes, you'll have good years and bad years, but having a long-term view of nurturing your culture, nurturing your people and investing in the business is the best way to make money in the long term. So that's what I would hope that the message goes down the generations of the way to run our business. But I also think it's very apt in the way that any business can be run in the future. So I'm just going to come on, just as I finish, to prison reform. And some of you will have read in the papers recently that sentiment has changed, and even politicians recognise that we can't keep going on locking up 85,000 people tonight, knowing that over 50% of them will be back in again within a year, and hardly any of them will manage to find work. We need to be very, very clear. We need fewer people in prison. Compliant prisoners need to be released early. And prisons need to be better run. Where you have an excellent governor running a prison, to me, it's a place of enlightenment. Lots of prisoners get help. Things seem to work. But we have a merry-go-round. I think prison governors move faster than Premiership football managers at the moment. And there's no way to run an organisation. But we need to significantly improve education. You know, my example of people playing cards with the ovens open when they're meant to be learning how to cook. Going into rooms full of computers, but none of them ever on. You know, we need to help our prisoners get qualifications so they can get a job. We have a health service that makes us better. We have an education system that teaches us. We have a defence service that keeps us safe. And we have a prison system that seems to keep us going back to prison. And that can't be right. So I'm hoping, as many of you may well be as well, that the future will be fewer prisons, but better prisons, and those people who do leave prison will have an opportunity to live a normal, fulfilling life, and hopefully companies like mine will be fortunate to have them serving you every day of the week. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, James, for that. What really struck me talking, this is not going to be terribly eloquent, but listening to that was the sense of how you've kept an idea of family at the heart, not just your family, but you talk about your colleagues, the culture of the organisation, even though you've grown rapidly. And how do you... And the other thing that struck me is all the groups you talk about, whether it's veterans, prisoners or care leavers, all the evidence shows what they need is networks of support, not just the work, but that kind of sense of an alternative network, an alternative family. How do you retain that and grow? Is there a tension?
Well, it comes back to culture. And whilst lots of people may think that our organisation is just very kind and we're lovely to everybody, actually we are pretty commercial and we are very, very strict on the quality of people who we have in the business. So if you're in, you'll love it, and we will love having you. But sometimes we recruit people who aren't right. And, you know, with good intentions, we thought they'd be fantastic, but it hasn't worked out. And I'm afraid they leave. And we need to do that to look after our good people. And that's how we've managed to create a culture where people do feel comfortable. They do feel that they're at home. They do feel that they're part of a family. And any culture that you look at that is a strong culture is rigorous on the people side of things. And from my experience, lots of organisations shy away from this problem. I don't know how many of you work in departments or offices, and everybody knows that there's some people in there who aren't good enough. And that undermines a culture. So we are pretty determined that to maintain our sweet spot, we need to maintain the quality of our people.
I don't know if there's people in the audience tonight that might be from sort of more traditional HR departments, perhaps, but it seems to me there's a real challenge there about your upside-down management and starting with this, I like the idea of these wonderful people and personality, but that's a very different model from certainly organisations I've worked with where you've got centralised HR and really a lot of the recruitment and the exit is about protecting the business from top down. How have you... Have you got a central HR? Do you have those issues?
Well, we don't have an HR department, no. We have a colleague support team, so sort of HR, but their job isn't to instill employment law. It is not to tell anybody what to do. It is to support our area teams in their job. So people would think, you know, the way we run things, you must have loads of tribunals. We have none, because we know our people, and I'm a big believer that if someone has a problem, it's normally from outside of work, it's our job to try and help them. And so many organisations just brush that under the carpet and just hit them with a letter from HR. As soon as you send a letter or start a process to do with people, you've lost it. So lots of conversations, lots of cuddles, let's see how we can help people out. And that's how we get often great colleagues who have a wobble back on and loyal and happy.
We'll start, and this is my last one, I promise you. Just to find that, I mean, I agree with everything you said about the sort of optimism around prison reform, but I think there's something else going on, which is kind of new forms of business, of which you are an example. And you talked about how you looked to John Lewis and those kinds of organisations. You're also, I believe, chair of the Employment Group on Reducing Offending and seen as a kind of one of these new types of business. How optimistic are you that there is really a sea change in how people are thinking about these kinds of issues?
But I think when I first started recruiting people from prison, I never told anyone, as I said earlier, what we were doing. We had terrible headlines. The worst ever was "Killer Cobbler Cuts Keys." That was a bad day at the office. And one of the reasons... So I would speak to chief execs, and they would say, "Oh, tell me what you're doing with this prison thing." And I'd explain, and they go, "That's a great idea." And then actually they would try and bury it because they were worried what their shareholders would say or what their colleagues would say. And I don't have the same conversation now. I have the conversation, yeah, I get this. How do I do it? So I wouldn't say all of them have got to the stage of going in recruiting regularly, but a number have got to the stage where they are doing it. But the fact is, businesses are very happy to take money off ex-offenders when they're walking on the street and buy things off them. So, and also, they're already employing lots of ex-offenders that they just don't know about. One of my most enjoyable things is occasionally I get asked to go on Five Live. Now, Five Live is great because it is properly live, so they can't edit it. And I always manage to get in. that the BBC employ more ex-offenders than I do, but they just don't know it. But the sentiment really is changing. And one of the things that I would dearly love is for the government to send a really strong signal by, for example, having no national insurance for the first year on someone who is recruited from the military or an ex-offender or a care leaver and so on. I think there are certain things that they can do to encourage business just to get them over the line. But again, these organisations, it doesn't have to be businesses, any organisation needs a leader who will stand up and take the flak and force it through.
Right, I'm hoping that all of that will have got you all warmed up to further questions, whether you're on HR or business.
Hello, good evening, Dan. My name is Mary. I'm deaf. And I'm quite interested in what you're saying about the prison service, because my late twin brother was in prison and he lost out, not having any opportunity. And being a deaf person in prison is a no-hoper. One of the questions I wanted to ask is, do your company look into recruiting deaf or disabled people into the business, giving them the support that they need in working with you on an equal level? Obviously, we do now have access to work funding to give communication support provision in the training or communicating within the team. I'd just like to know, have you seen any deaf people in prison? Because so far, we have about 500 deaf people now in prison on the basis of social deprivation or being socially disadvantaged, partly because of a lack of understanding of our need to communicate and be part of society as equal. But I'd like to know if Timpson has actually look out for those deaf people in prison and get them into business to give them hope.
Thank you. And then there was one here. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you very much for that. I was interested in the contrast you were talking about between a business like John Lewis, which is obviously a partnership, and Richard Sands, which I believe is privately held, all the way through to the other end, which are mostly publicly held businesses. And there's a conflict between the long-term view that a privately held business can take and the quarter-by-quarter kind of always-on mentality that a chief exec for a public entity needs to take. And I wondered whether there was any evidence that you had seen where the larger public companies who have this constant pressure from shareholders, whether they'd been able to take the long view with their employees, as some of the successful stories in the private sector have been able to do.
Okay, that's good. I have to think about that one. To answer your question on recruiting deaf people in prison, I haven't, but that's not because I haven't. I consciously not. It's just we haven't found any to interview, as far as I'm aware. But I have a team who are in prisons 3-4 days a week recruiting, so I will ask them. But we do have a number of deaf people working for us, more so in our warehouse and in our office. So all we're interested in is personality. That's the key to us. So whether you're deaf or or whatever, it doesn't matter. We just want you for your personality. But no, it's an interesting point actually about how prisons cope with people who are deaf, and I suspect not very well is the answer. To answer your question about public companies and how it works, if you look at Germany has a large proportion of family businesses, far larger than we have. And I come from the northwest of England, which again has a high proportion of big family businesses. Warburton's Bread being one of them. We have lots of brewers as well in the northwest. And if you look at the German model of long-term family ownership, to me that is the best way to grow over the long term and look after your employees as well. I'm sure there are numbers of examples of public companies that have a long-term view, but I suspect they can't manage it the way we do, because they've got shareholders who want dividends and they've got to report to the city all the time. And it just doesn't work. I'm not saying that that business model is wrong, but it takes a very strong leader and a very strong board, normally with a shareholder who has a large proportion of the shares, to make that happen. But if you look at various statistics on the best model for business for long-term growth, it is a family business.
Thank you very much, James. You obviously feel very passionately about the situation in the prisons, and you've made, commercially, this works very well for you. I'm just wondering if the next logical thing for you to do is to actually run prisons.
Okay, good question.
Hi, James, Nicole Berg, and I loved everything you're saying and taking copious notes, and by that I mean tweets. But I wanted to ask you, I know you don't frame it as CSR, yeah, you frame it as good business sense and make a strong case for it, but it definitely can be looked at as CSR, and rather than allocating it to a department, you've built it right into your business and your model. I wonder if you have any other ideas about, you know, other ways to do that and other ways that other companies can embrace CSR creatively in that way.
Okay, two good questions. So, yes, I am interested in running prisons, and I am part of a group that is proposing to run an academy prison. Whether it will get off the ground, I don't know, but we've got a meeting with the prisons minister in 2 weeks' time, where there's a group of us who are pretty keen on having a go and just see what happens. But the reason why I'm really interested in doing it is to prove that that prisons can be run differently. And do I want to be the person who's actually running a prison? No. But I'd like to be one of those who gets the ball rolling on change. So, you know, I think we're fortunate that Michael Gove has come from education where, you know, where academy schools were very much part of his agenda anyway. So, and there is lots of people who are talking about it and thinking it's a good thing to do. So, let's see with that. CSR. I worry about CSR. Lots of companies, chief executives, do CSR on a Friday afternoon, 4:30 to 5 o'clock. And they have a CSR department who sort of work away, and it's not really taken seriously by the business. I don't think CSR really has a future like that at all. What I think is important is that companies need to have an ethos running all the way through, which is it's not just about making money. It's about having a great, engaged, happy workforce. And to do that, you need, at certain points, to engage with your community, with your neighbours. And it's not, you know, there are examples of schools that have 7 coats of paint because groups have gone in just to go and paint a school or a scout hut or something like that. Again, those days are over for CSR, I believe. And I think it's about making it a normal part of the business, not just an offshoot of a small team that are really engaged but don't have the support from the leadership. So I can see CSR departments disappearing, but I can see the role of community and neighbourhoods and environment and education being very much more part of businesses all the way through.
I was just going to jump in there, which is one of the... I've worked in prisons on the other side, and people are really aware when they're part of the charity case. And they might appreciate that, but they're very aware when they're sort of on a sideline, something that the business does is something good, you know, in aside to their main business. And they're incredibly aware when they're actually a colleague, the language you use, because it completely changes every relationship you have. You put your strategy together, you work together as colleagues. And I think you shouldn't underestimate how different it feels for the kind of the member of staff as well as for everyone else. Right, more questions?
How many people have you taken from prisons, and have you had any failures?
We've had a number of failures, especially in the early days when we first started. We had a high proportion. Out of the 750 people we've recruited from prison, I know of 4 that have gone back to prison. There may be more, but I don't think so, which is actually less than the colleagues who work for me who haven't been to prison but have gone back into prison. So I don't know what that tells you. When it goes wrong, it goes really wrong. And half of the time, it's probably our fault that we haven't managed it properly. And the other half of the time, I suspect, is the individual's fault. They're not ready for it. And we sort of fell into a trap of wanting to recruit people just because we really like them, but we didn't really understand the complex nature of some of their problems. And, you know, we went through a stage of spending an awful lot of time and money picking people up from the prison gates, taking them to digs, buying them duvets, toothbrush, toothpaste, bus passes, and doing everything for them. And then there would be, you know, everything would start working. The worst thing we've ever done for our ex-offenders is put them on a stage like this in front of people like you and said how well they've done. Every time I've done it, it's gone wrong. I don't understand why, but every time, it always goes wrong. So sometimes it's just bad luck. We've had, more recently, a number of ex-offenders working for us leave because they can earn more money in construction, especially down south, so I see that as a positive thing. But sometimes the people we recruit from prison, they are just, that their problems are too complex to work in a shop, and maybe they're just not ready for us, but we hope they would be.
I'm interested in going back to the days when you started to change the culture at Timpson, and particularly because to me it strikes me that Timpson, the way you run the business is kind of the opposite to how a lot of managers and leaders are taught to run a business, and how you manage to get the willing cooperation of your leaders within the organisation to approach it in a very different way to perhaps what they were used to and taught.
I think it helps that we only recruit from within. I always worry when organisations recruit senior people in right at the top level who come with their own culture. Often they bring in their own team, their own people. And you end up with putting more and more rules and processes in place to cope with all these different cultures coming in one. So what I learned very quickly is never recruit anybody from outside. I did do 2 years ago, and again it went horribly wrong, so I've actually got a sign in my office saying, remind me, never recruit anybody from outside the business again. Or promote someone from outside the business. So I think recruiting people from within is very important. But also, I had a real problem with middle management. People who'd been in the business a long time, they liked the fact that they could tell everyone what to do. The shops were their pawns. And it took me a long time to either convince them that that wasn't the right way to do it, or for them to find their happiness elsewhere. Because, you know, I can only try so hard, but it's middle management that's the problem. And every week I spend 2 or 3 days a week going around my shops to meet our colleagues to find out what's going on. But what I'm really looking for is signs of where the culture's not working. And it's normally not working because our middle management team, for some reason, there's something in us, we like to tell people what to do. We like to try and invent these little rules and these little systems to stop the odd person doing something or to make their lives easier. And that's what I clamp down on. So I wouldn't say it's perfect. Actually, I counted on the train on the way down. I had 3 emails from customers of complaints of watches that we've repaired that haven't worked or things we've lost. So our business is far from perfect. But what I do know is if you recruit people from within who really know the business and they get it, you're less likely to struggle with the culture.
Interesting. There's one more at the back here.
Hi, thank you. This is all really interesting and massively relevant to the work that I do. I run training cafes for homeless people and ex-offenders, and I'd just love to hear a bit about what makes your training programmes particularly effective.
I think number one is we treat everybody as an equal. We don't call them ex-offenders. They are foundation colleagues. They wear our uniform. They use our training manuals. We encourage them. If they aren't doing things correctly, we explain it in a nice, normal way that it would be in a shop. So in the actual environment that they're working in is exactly as it would be on the outside, even though they have bars. In fact, we cover up the bars so they can't be seen. But we also take more time. There's an awful lot of change going on in people's lives when they're about to leave prison. There's an awful lot of anxieties and concerns. And even when they've just left prison and they're starting their journey into a normal life, again, it's not as straightforward often as it is for someone you recruit off the street. So I think taking time, but the real key for us is to put an amazing trainer with them. Someone who is kind, someone who has got a huge amount of experience, someone who is tough, someone who is prepared to listen and is more of a listener than a talker.
And how many of those people come through from shop floor and become trainers?
All of our trainers in our training academies in prisons aren't ex-offenders themselves. Although I have a colleague called Darren, who is my foundation ambassador. So he's the guy who goes around the prisons recruiting for me. He himself is an ex-offender. So he really gets it, and he's sort of better at navigating some of the invented prison rules than I am. But those colleagues who we recruit into our training programs in prison, virtually all of them come through, and all the ones that sort of rise through the ranks quite quickly, virtually all of them come through our training academies.
people was...
Because I mentioned, Halfords have a training academy in Onley Prison, so they went to see one of ours in Liverpool. They really, really like the idea. They have a problem in Halford stores that all the bikes that they sell come in bits in a box from China, and they need the skills of how to assemble a bike properly. So they've set one up in Onley, and it's been a massive success for them.
It is, it is definitely beginning to happen more. I mean, one thing that's changed is you have workshops still there, where it's got nothing to do with employment. It is to do with bums on seats. So, for example, costing up a job would be impossible. So when people do leave, they leave with false hope on some occasions because they think they've been trained in something that's got absolutely nothing to do with the real world of work. So I really like the idea of replicating that work environment as well as the getting up, going to work.
Hi. Well, that's inspiring and crazy, and I like it. So how you keep crazy happening when there is failure at the start? So... And the compliment for this question is you have been acting as intrapreneur within your organization, daring to do different things, innovating within the system, and failing. But you still regain and kept the license to continue being crazy and creating change that sustains. How did you do that?
Well, firstly, I think it's normal.
Crazy became normal.
The reason why I did, I'm a really commercial person. You know, I look at our company bank balance every day. I look at our profit figures every week. I know the profit that every shop, every one of my 1,450 shops make. I know it every month. I'm a commercial guy. The reason why I do these things is because I think it's the right way to run a business commercially. If I wanted to make less money, I'd put a load of rules in place. I'd recruit anybody. And I would stop doing all the really nice things. But I want to make good money, and I see this as the right way to go about it. I'll give you one example. We do a thing called Perfect Day. So every shop has to have one day when everything is perfect. So it's spotlessly clean, all the lights work, in the first aid box, all the plasters are there, the Savlon, everything's there that's perfect. So we decided to do one in the office as well, because we can't have our shops having a perfect day if in the office we don't have a perfect day as well. So a lot of companies would make it boring. Tick boxes, going around, and then give a little prize out. We make it fun. Everybody dresses up. Departments get prizes for the themes. So finance this year came second. They had their theme was, their perfect day was a wedding. So that we had a whole aisle. We had wedding cakes. We had bridesmaids. We had grooms. We had everything. And I think everything we try and do, we try and make it fun and interesting, because who wants to do boring? And I want my colleagues, when they see their friends in the pub, to say, you wouldn't believe what happened last week. You know, so when we have a football tournament, it's an amazing football tournament. If we're going to do anything, you do it really, really well, or don't bother doing it at all. And I worry that organisations sort of do token things, but it's not about spending loads of money. It's about just making it fun. Perfect Day works really well, by the way.
Hi, James. I'm Jerry Lockspizer. I'm also a Tinson customer, I'm proud to say. I'm on my fourth, I think, battery in my watch under the Get a Watch Battery for Life scheme,
which
I highly recommend to everybody else, but not anything to do with the company. But the original reason that I went for that. That was the original reason. I needed a new watch battery, so I went to one of your shops and I got this thing for life, and it's great. But now I'm very keeping with you because of the mission and the purpose of the company. And my question is, how much does the collegiate, everything you've explained about your attitude to business, and particularly the part about the prisons, get communicated to the customers at large, and how do they respond if it does?
Okay, when we first started the lifetime guarantee scheme for watch batteries, I wasn't anticipating when people go back four times to get a watch battery. Anyway, good on you, one up. As I said earlier, when we first started recruiting people from prisons, I didn't tell anybody anything. And when it was announced, we have a weekly newsletter that goes around. So we sort of started to communicate that way. And I did road shows by going around the country. But the way we really communicate our culture is difficult. It's very difficult to communicate a culture. So our methods are, in our shops, we have graphics around the shops, which is all about culture. We're not trying to sell you anything. So the graphics say that all of our colleagues get their birthday off, that we have holiday homes, There's a sign in every shop saying, the colleagues in the shop have our total authority to give you amazing service. So, and we also have our weekly newsletter, which is all good news. We never, ever do bad news. And it's not good news about how much money we've made, or it's good news about someone's daughter's passed their driving test, or that someone's dogs have had, you know, have had 10 puppies, or someone's got their skill test or become a manager or had a record week. So we are quite clear on sort of controlling the communication of culture, and that's myself and my dad's role as being the ambassadors of culture, and we take it very, very seriously. So, yeah, any communication that goes out, I'm all over it.
Hello, I'm Angus Jenkinson. I really like what you were saying about CSR, and the analogy I'd like to ask is, how do you make sure that everyday work, as opposed to perfect days and those fancy things, how do you make sure that everyday work works?
Okay.
We'll come back to you then. There was one right in the middle there. Yep.
How important do you think that it was that you were exposed to the prison early on in your life with regard to the Foster story? And do you think that that should be more relevant to young people today to take away some of the stigmatism of prison?
And then a final question here.
Thanks. Marisa Cumber from Ravensbourne. We are desperate to teach digital skills inside of prisons because there's a huge digital skills gap. And every time we have approached a prison, our emails have not been responded to, and they say, we're not in interest. Could you give advice as to actually how to break through that barrier? Because I'm sure a lot of companies want to encourage and do work within those environments, but haven't got an avenue in.
Okay, right. On the first question, every business, every organisation needs a drug. What makes people go to work in the morning and work really hard? What makes our colleagues, when you walk into our shops, try and sell you the second key or try and sell you a lifetime guarantee battery? For us, we have a drug which is called commission. So in our shops, the way it works is we have a formula. Don't worry, I won't
mention it.
Which is you add up the wages of everybody working in the shop and you times it by 4.5. It just works. There's no sort of science behind it. It just works. And that's when you do that calculation, it sets a sales target each week. And anything over that target, our colleagues get 15% with no cap. We haven't changed the formula in 20 years. So there's two incentives. One is to go for it every week. And I always worry about organisations who have monthly, quarterly, six-monthly targets. Most people think week to week. So every week you want to go and take as much money as possible. And the other is you want to do it on as lower wages as possible. Because most organisations, someone says, well, I could do that, but I need more people. I need more hours. I need more support. And that is our drug. So that's why when you go into our shops, they're busy. You know, they're doing things all the time. They don't have much time to chat to me. Because they are serving customers because they want to earn the commission. So it basically works out at 7.5% of sales and they earn as commission. So we have some colleagues who earn £200-300 every week in commission, but they work really hard and they deserve it. In some ways, it's a sort of a profit share, but that's the drug. And you know, I don't think you can expect people to turn up and sell and be amazing unless they have a real incentive to do so. So that's how we do it. Okay, and the next question
was
fostering. Yeah. Okay, so have any of you heard of the Clink restaurant? The thing I think is wonderful about the Clink is it doesn't just give prisoners an opportunity to gain skills and serve customers. It also gives an opportunity for people who've never been into a prison or been involved with prisons to take part in it. And they've opened a new one in Stile Prison, one of the first ones I ever went to, and it's now number one on TripAdvisor, the best restaurant in Cheshire. And the one in Brixton, I think, is broken into the top 20 in London. So, but yes, I think as prisons are reformed, I want them to become more open. I want them to become places where people don't think of just bad things happen and bad people live. And I think the more people that can be encouraged to be open-minded and to see what goes on, the better. Completely different angle. Tesco have had a huge amount of success with their Farm to Fork program of bringing young kids into the stores and show them how the whole food chain works. And so I do think it's about education, but I was lucky that I always felt comfortable with prisons. I was intrigued by them, but I think lots of people do feel intimidated and scared. And the last question.
Digital skills, how do we get digital skills to be recognised as a core competency in prisons? Is that right?
Yeah. Okay, so I hear lots of examples of the similar sort of problem you're talking about. Number one is only approach prisons where the governor is brilliant. If the governor isn't great, don't bother. If you want to know which the good ones are, send me an email, james@timpson.com, and I'll tell you which are the ones to try approaching. So there's no point emailing a prison because, in my view, they never respond. Write a handwritten letter to the governor. Normally works better. But the real trick for me is to engage NOMS, National Offender Management Service, basically head office down in Victoria. Because if you get the buy-in from them, things seem to happen. And one of the issues is prison governors have lots of reasons to say no. Lots of excuses. Is it money? Is it budget? Is it time? Is it manning? So we take away the excuses. That's the way we do it. But it's hard. I have seen some good examples, actually, of the digital agenda being pushed in prisons. In fact, recently I was in Hatfield Prison near Doncaster, and they were doing some really good work. But they are way, way behind. One of the biggest issues for prisons is they can't go on the internet. So it's hard. Nowadays, most of our kids educate themselves significantly by using the internet, but they can't use the internet. So that's one of the things we're trying to resolve. I've been around prisons in Norway where they're all on the internet all the time. Not a problem.
But I think, and that's a good place to stop, because I think one of the things that this medal kind of marks, if you like, is increasing the permission to do things that at the moment are thought as too risky. And I think organisations like Timpson's and people like James kind of broaden that permission. And to go back to that question of, you know, where are we with prison reform, I think there are really unusually reasons to be cheerful at the moment. There does seem to be a different conversation going on. And I think, you know, to reward and to acknowledge and thank someone like James that kind of stretches that boundary about what is possible. And I think we'd like to say thank you for today, but also thank you for that contribution. And congratulations for your Albert Medal.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.